So this is the West Coast Project podcast channel for Fargo TV. Hey, Michelle.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, and I'm Mike. Thanks for reminding me. Hey, so we're on episode 3 of Muddy Road, which I thought was really good. I think it was maybe my favorite one so far. How did you like it?
I completely agree. After last week's, I wasn't sure, and I wasn't sure where we were going to go, and I thought this was great. It's a great episode.
So before we dive into it, I had a little bit of time over the weekend, and I don't know why, but I started rewatching the first few episodes, and I came up on some stuff on the rewatch that it might have been obvious to other people, but I'll take the bullet and I'll make these observations, even if they seem kind of dumb. They weren't apparent to me right away, but maybe it'll help others who didn't catch them either. In the first episode, when Melville's listening, we talked about this crazy radio station. Mm-hmm. He's listening to the cassette tapes of the calls that he's recorded from people.
Oh, is that what he was listening to when he hears the banging?
Yeah.
In the trunk?
That's what's coming through his car radio. And we'll hear a little bit more of it in this episode when we see Phil in the trunk again. Another thing I found out that I missed was, you know, that Molly and Vern knew that Hess was tied up with gunrunners outside of Fargo, so they knew he was into evil stuff. I just took Hess as kind of a creepy, semi-shady businessman, but Molly and Vern really knew that he was connected into some real crime in Fargo.
Yeah, I didn't get that they knew. I got that they suspected, but you think they actually knew some stuff.
Well,
right?
It sounded like it was something that they kind of knew, yeah, that he was tied in with some bad people in Fargo.
Okay.
And then the final thing is that that mitzvah tank, that Jewish mitzvah tank RV that was in mm-hmm. front of Gus and Greta's apartment, that was also parked in front of the Phoenix Farms supermarket.
Oh, I didn't notice that either.
And I don't know why or what reason it had to be there, but, you know, that was in front of the supermarket, too.
Huh. Interesting.
So this Muddy Road episode, this is the second episode that runs over an hour. It runs for an hour and 15 minutes. And it's got some tricky things that we need to talk about that are going to be hard to kind of fit into the right order here. So it kind of starts and ends with theologies, different religious viewpoints. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can dig into the meanings at the end. And, of course, anyone listening to this probably knows it's totally spoiler full. We're going to talk about everything and anything. So if you haven't seen the episode, probably stop listening and watch the episode and come back to it. But A Muddy Road is a parable. And like I said, we can maybe get into its meaning at the end of the episode of our podcast episode, but do you want to go through what happens kind of sequentially in the first few shots?
Yeah, well, this time we actually start out a little bit differently. Before, we've never started out this way, but this starts out with a flashback. You're not sure, I don't think, when it first comes on that it is, but it's a flashback that shows the sequence of events that led up to the naked guy being in Malvo's trunk at the beginning. And it shows a gray building. Everything's gray, 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 bland, lifeless. And we follow down a hallway and come to a brightly colored, warm-looking cubicle. But there's a guy in there that's completely distressed. He's looking at a piece of paper. He's looking down the hallway. He's obviously in distress, and then he sees Malvo standing at the end of the hallway. And then
This was a fresh Malvo victim or a new caper that Malvo was getting involved in when you first saw
it? Yeah, I did. I didn't recognize the guy as a naked trunk guy. Did you?
No, not at all.
Yeah. So Malvo comes with just complete boldness, grabs him by his tie. The guy's begging him. He pulls him, drags him. The guy's laying on his back being dragged out and out to the parking garage. And Malvo pulls out a knife, cuts his clothes off, throws him in a trunk. And then we see the sequence of what happened with the guy. It shows an inside trunk view of the car crash and everything else. And you're saying that's where you heard again the cassette tape.
Yeah, you can hear it again, or if you just have your captions on, you can see some of the words. It's like, you know, oh no, please don't, or somebody protesting on a phone call that he's got recorded on his you know, a series of cassettes that he saves.
Yeah, that's neat. I did not recognize that before. That's an interest. So he's even listened to this stuff in the car.
I still thought, even in the trunk ride, that this was not, that this was still a new caper. I didn't know that that was the guy. And I thought, wow, they're really showing that these trunks are not nice, comfy rides. He's really getting bounced around. But yeah. Then when it pops up and he jumps out, then I kind of realized it was a flashback.
When I saw the wreck, when it looked like the wreck, that's when actually when he started beating on the trunk, that's when it dawned on me, oh, this is Naked Trunk Guy. And then it showed the wreck and all that from the inside of the trunk, which I thought was a pretty cool scene. I don't know if we've ever seen anything like that before.
Yeah. We also learned that lots of people have seen Malvo now, and he's on video, and he's really very unconcerned about who discovers what he's up to. He walks in and out of everywhere, just plain as day, and that was interesting.
Isn't that strange to you? Because we assume, based on episode one, that Malvo is, this is what he does, and how could that be if he were so... He's not very stealth or ninja-ish. He just walks in, handles stuff, and walks away. And all it would have taken in that situation in the building is somebody to have grabbed him, or maybe security to have come, somebody to have pulled a weapon or something. And he is unconcerned.
Yep.
So
Malvo goes to see Don at Squat. That's what I was talking about with you earlier. Squat is the place where Don does his training.
Mm-hmm.
A very very low energy women, it looked like.
I noted that too. Yeah, definitely different than Gina Hess was.
Yeah, so Malvo, when he's talking to Don, Malvo is so, he's like exquisitely concise. He just says directly what he means in like three or four words. I love that.
Yeah, he's definitely directive with Don.
And he uncovers the blackmail, or he doesn't uncover it, but he reveals to Don that he's got the blackmail uncovered. They have their little talk in the little closet. That was pretty funny.
And poor Don. Don's just like hyperventilating and just having a really hard time with being caught.
He's an idiot.
He's not the smartest.
Okay, so what's next?
Well, so... Malvo does the two questions and one comment, and he just, you know, he's just very directive, like what you were saying. I thought that was pretty good. It still didn't really explain to me why he wanted the $43,613. He was going to buy a Turkish bath, but that's very specific amount of money.
Probably super incriminating, too. Like, somewhere on some lease somewhere, there's probably that exact amount that he needs to sign off on. You know, it's probably really stupid that figure is exactly what something else is related to Don that would totally incriminate him if they put all the facts together.
Right, which goes back to what you said. He's just stupid. You know, just makes no sense for him to ask for that. Prior to that, though, we see Molly going into the office building and... McDonough and Snoats Accounting and Consulting, which is evidently what Naked Trunk Guy, where he worked. And this is where she sees Malvo for the first time. And she sees him on the video camera. And the people in the office are talking with her and kind of gossiping about what they think he might have been involved in and all that. But it was just kind of important to note, I think, that this is where Molly first sees...
I noticed that too. It reminded me that Molly doesn't know Malvo yet. She hasn't seen him yet. Out of all this time that we've spent so far.
Right, and we've seen him so much and so many times. Okay, so then we go to Gus Grimley. He's at his desk and he's thinking back over everything that happens. He flashes back to seeing the license tag, and he flashes back to seeing Malvo's face and all that. And Gus is really regretful. He seems kind of... I think this is where Gus sees that he needs to do the right thing and go tell his lieutenant. We kind of see that on his face. And the lieutenant's in the bathroom, and he goes in there and tells him kind of the whole story. I thought the interesting thing of that was the lieutenant, of course, when he hears that the car was stolen from the guy that was in that was one of the victims, he jumps up and comes out of the stall of the bathroom and he says, "It's Sioux Falls all over again."
Yeah.
And then they kind of leave us with that.
Yeah. So, there was a crime. There was a pretty big crime in Sioux Falls. I don't know if it's the crime or the task force that we later hear Molly's dad talking about.
Yeah, I think it was. I think so.
Well, I don't know if that. I don't know if those two things may be related, the crime that they're referring to and then Molly's dad's task force. But there was also a big crime where some boys killed some people camping in Sioux Falls in real life back in the 70s. I don't know if we want to get into that at all, but that was, that's, if you Reddit it or Google it, you can find out just Sioux Falls murders. You can read about it, but this was something that happened. So I don't understand yet how it might be related to our story here.
Right. Or if they just have their own big deal that happened in Sioux Falls. Yeah. I don't know. I just think it's interesting that they keep bringing it up.
So Gus did something very interesting to me in the bathroom when he was talking to the lieutenant. He claims he pulled this Lester over, or not Lester, but Malvo over for speeding. And later on in this episode, he tells Molly he pulls him over for blowing a stop sign. So he changes his story really pretty suspiciously to me. Like, I wonder why he made it two different things. Unless that's just a continuity thing, or he's just at first trying to lie, maybe tell a little bit of the truth to the lieutenant and hoping he can get out of it. But when he totally comes clean with everybody later with Molly, he admits it was a stop sign. And that's what I think it really was. If you think back about Lauren driving through the snow and skidding around the corner, as he kind of blows a stop sign.
Yeah, I didn't take that as being too weird. I think, but I could certainly be wrong. I took it as he was speeding and he sped through the stop sign. And I just didn't even relate that to anything being dishonest or anything or underhanded in Gus's story. But I don't know. That's a good point.
Okay, so what's next?
Okay, so next we have Lester. They show him sitting at home and he's eating a meal at the same table. He's remembering his wife, Pearl, and the stuff she said. He remembers Vern getting shot. And then there's all of these affirmation, which I think we're kind of seeing Pearl's, personality still showing through in these affirmations on the refrigerator, these magnets and hope and dream and all this kind of stuff. It's just, and it's really so different. It's like she wanted to be one way, but she was really just like this nagging shrew.
Don't you think that's true in life, that the people that are prejudiced, sometimes like they're prejudiced against homosexuals or you know, races of people that they, you know, they're really sometimes are homosexual, or it's that weird irony of life that they pretend to be strong or pretend to be mad at something that they really are themselves.
I think that we dislike stuff in other people, maybe sometimes that we dislike in ourselves, and that's why we feel so much power toward the dislike, is because it's so personal to us. So yeah, I can definitely see that.
I thought that scene was pretty cool though, in the kitchen where Lester was just surrounded by ghosts. You know, he just sees ghosts and hears ghosts, and Pearl's really haunting him.
Yeah, Pearl's still there. She's there in every way, in his mind and in every little nuance around him. We still see Pearl, and then he still has the harshness and the realization of everything else that he's caused by this. So he doesn't like being there, I think, is the main point of this scene. And he doesn't like being there because of the ghosts that are still there. So he goes back to Beaumont's insurance company where he works. And he goes in and they give him a hug and they tell him that they're glad he's there. They can't believe he's back so quickly. And what we find out later on is, do you realize that this is just like 3 days later? Because later on, Gus mentions to Molly that he pulled Malvo over 3 days ago. So, I mean, maybe 3, 4, 5 days at the most. I mean, and really not even that long. It really should just be 3 because Lester's car was gone.
Yeah.
I just think it's crazy short.
Yeah, I also that's interesting. I made a weird connection too with the Beaumont Insurance company, because the Muddy Road is a kind of a Zen monk parable, and they spell their monk M-U-N-K as the guy's name and the insurance agency. But I thought that was an interesting name to use for that company.
Oh, that is. Yeah, I didn't think about that. That's interesting. Bo mentions that he's fixing to go see the widow Hess, Gina Hess, Sam's widow, to take her some forms to fill out. And he's how would you describe him?
Who?
He's completely insensitive, Bo. He's talking about, well, because Sam was murdered, and the office girl's kind of looking at him like, maybe we don't want to talk about somebody being murdered. And he's just this big, you know, big lug, like, well, what? Kind of, I don't know.
Yeah, he was a dope. But the office girl stood out to me, too. Like, she seems so totally nice. Like, nice people in this show really stand out as the oddities. You know, they're the rare ones in the show. And this Asian woman was just really nice. Like, oh, she was really genuinely happy to see Lester. Like, he looked okay. And she was concerned about him. And, you know, she asked him if he wanted Arby's, and she just seemed like a really nice person, and that stood out to me.
Yeah, anybody that has any warmth, I think, stands out. It's not just nice, because anybody could be nice, you know, but anybody that shows any warmth toward anybody else is what I really noticed. It's because everything is so bland, and all the personalities are so muted, that when you see somebody with genuine smiles and warmth like Molly and this office girl.
Well, contrast this office girl with Phil's office workmates, where they just like threw him under the bus, you know, with all their theories on why he was going south with his life.
Phil,
the guy who got thrown in the trunk and frozen.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They don't even, yeah, they're, well, they made the comment about the gossiping comments and kind of came to life with that. But yeah, they just kind of stand and watch it.
So this Asian woman was so different than them. Like, she was warm and kind. You didn't get the idea that she would ever gossip like that about Lester if she had the chance to.
No.
But anyway.
So anyway, Lester goes out to Gina Hess's. What do you think about this whole scene? This was a really good scene, I thought.
I love Kate Walsh. She's like nothing short of awesome.
Isn't she great?
Yeah, and she's like in her mid-40s, too. She's just a babe. She's totally great in this scene.
She is. She looks rough when she answers the door, and her dopey sons are out there, Mickey and Moe, and they're shooting arrows into the real estate side. She wants to get out of here.
There are a couple of Daryl wannabes walking around the yard with their crossbows.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, they're walking around. They're just like, and not probably have the IQ to maybe be carrying a weapon like that. But yeah, and she's not overly fond of her boys, we find out. She calls them wolves and animals but did you notice how she warmed up to Lester when she found out why he was there?
Yeah, of course. You know, yeah. She's pretty transparent.
Yeah, which was kind of great. She's trying to play Lester. And poor Lester. Poor Lester. And you probably won't hear me say that a lot, but he was completely a fish out of water. He was out of his element with this beautiful, seductress top woman coming on to him for her own gain, but coming on to him.
Yeah, the sexiest thing she did was when she said, "You should get back out there." Like, that was more sexy to me than the stripper moves and all the dancing around him and, you know, the showing him she had great breasts and all that. That was really, the encouragement was really a turn on. like, you should just get back out there, you know, you know, go out and date and whatever. I know she was working him, but still, there was a little hint of like encouragement in there too.
It's been 3 days. She thinks this guy, she doesn't know he hit his wife in the head with a hammer. And it's been 3 days. I thought it was wildly inappropriate. And I thought his response to her was so appropriately inappropriate that I just thought it was great. He was taken in. And I can't imagine that you could be that way 3 days after your wife was brutally murdered.
But he murdered her because he was fed up with her.
Yeah, but we're not supposed, I mean, we know that, but we're not supposed to know that by his actions. And not only is he back at work, but he's back at work and he's able to be taken in by, and she tells him, she was a stripper, I was good at it. She was, limber? What'd she say? Flexible? She's throwing her, thigh up over his shoulder and says crazy stuff. And he's awkwardly eating it up, I thought. What did you think? Did you think he was enjoying it or not?
He was a man. He was being worked by the female wiles and charms of, a seductive female. They exaggerated it to the nth degree, but still that's the message, you know. She was able to work him, you know. She offers him whiskey. I don't know what time of day it is, but they're just going out to lunch, so it's not very far into the afternoon at the latest.
Mm-hmm.
She's got the whiskey already out on the countertop in the kitchen, and it's just you know, she's like the bare essence of Las Vegas, you know, stripper, whiskey, smoking, kids playing recklessly in the yard. It was just perfect.
Right. And I think that we should note that the boys were threatening Lester when he came up. Then they saw their mom kind of coming on to him. Of course, she's doing it in front of a big picture window. And they see it, and of course, Mo shoots Mickey in the behind with his big, big crossbow because he's distracted and angry over what he sees through the window. It's just such a doof. But then the mom's looking out the window, which causes Lester to look out the window, and that's where he sees Numbers and Ranch.
Yeah.
Standing out there.
It also wasn't the first time that Mo shot Mickey with the crossbow dart. She's like, again?
Oh, I know. And she's not even concerned. This kid's got this arrow sticking out of him and falling forward. And she just throws her hands up in disgust and puts her robe back on. That was her thing. She was acting like she was more disgusted by having to stop her seduction.
She was interrupted, yeah.
Right. But that was creepy, them standing outside the house like that at the edge of the woods and seeing what was going on. I thought that was disturbing.
I didn't notice Numbers and Wrench too much. Maybe I was too distracted by Kate Walsh, man. But
uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I guess that's the whole point, is they see this and then they misinterpret what they think is going on.
I would think that in that situation, because they come into his office, and we'll talk about that in just a minute, but I would think that they would expect him to be there. This could have been Bo, and it should have been Bo, right? Because Bo Monk was on his way out there to take her the papers. So then would Bo have been the one that was the, you know, the one that got their aggressiveness?
Could have been. I mean, it's not the first time the wrong person went to the wrong time place at the wrong time, you know?
Right. I wasn't sure if they were trying to show us that kind of thing, that it was just, they just take out anybody in their path. Because you would expect the insurance people to show up, although you wouldn't necessarily expect her to be doing a striptease in front of them. I don't know. So then we go to a scene where there's a van and there's a guy and he opens up the back of the van. And what did you think that was hanging in the ivy bags?
Pee.
Was it urine? Is that what it was supposed to be?
Yeah, of
clean
course.
Urine? Well, I didn't know. I mean, there's stuff called TPN that is a kind of like an IV solution for people that's, full of stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, he's selling pee tests. fake pee test to get people out, you know. Probably people on parole have to take pee tests, and I know athletes do to pass, you know, to make sure they're drug free. That's pretty cool. I couldn't read what was on those bags, but that's, for me, that's exactly what it meant. I think that was meant to be pretty obvious.
Okay, well, you know, since I've seen IV bags of stuff like that, I wasn't sure. So, but anyway, it's like this drug van, and Malvo's there, and he buys Adderall.
Yep, but no zombie kit.
Yeah, he won't go for the zombie. But what do you think that was about? Just like a nod to Walking Dead?
I don't know. I could see somebody in that line of business having a zombie kit. Why not? You know, probably get some people to buy it.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought that was kind of strange that he had zombie backpacks made up in the back of his drug van. Okay, so then we come to the scene where Molly meets with a girl in the restaurant.
Yeah, the unluckiest dating girl in the world. I don't even know her name. Did she have a name?
No, and I couldn't find it. I actually tried to look it up, and I couldn't find it. It was she's gullible. She's stupid. Molly said something about, oh, my gun's just wooden, and she goes, really? The whole thing was just showing how gullible I think maybe the girl was.
That unnamed girl, though, she really rocked the scene. She kind of stole the scene. And I don't know why even this scene was in there. although it did give Molly the chance to refer to the murders as "It's a Muddy Road," which,
well,
kind of is the title of our episode.
Right.
What did you think it meant?
I thought it was a complete nod to the movie.
I guess it was a nod for sure. But what in the context of the story? Like, she's just having lunch with a friend?
Well, she goes back to the spider. Remember, the friend talks about the spider that laid eggs in a guy's neck, and the little baby spiders came out of his neck. And at the end of it, Molly says, "I don't want to live in a world. I don't think I want to live in a world where stuff like that can happen."
Yeah, I guess in the movie too, Margie didn't really have much of a reason in her story in the movie to go see Mike either. It was just kind of a weird, quirky little scene. But it was funny. I mean, I liked it. So okay. next we see Malvo. Super slow motion Malvo. Slow-mo Malvo at the King's house, right?
Yeah, he just doesn't care again.
He walks so deliberately and slowly. And I love the split screen almost view of, like, the King and Malvo doing their two different things. And he just barely gets out the door in time.
We see him in there switching out the medication for whatever Stavros was taking. And I couldn't figure that out either. It said acetaminophen, of course, Tylenol with something. And I never could figure out what that was. Did you catch what he was taking before?
Yeah, I think it was either. Pretty innocuous. It wasn't like a serious medication. It was just like a pain reliever, like that he chews on constantly because he's stressed out from all his high pressure wheelings and dealings.
Okay.
That's what I took from it. It wasn't like a heart medicine or something. It was just like a pain reliever.
But Malvo switches that out with the Adderall, which is just pretty much speed. But this is the terrible scene. It's terrible where he kills the dog.
Yeah, everybody on the internet hates this scene. I don't know. It was just to me another scene. I didn't really like gasp or think, oh God, what a mean, awful guy. He's already kind of a criminal guy. And killing the dog was just kind of a means to an end of him completing this scene. It's also kind of a completion to the "it's a dog eat dog world," you know, that he tells. Who did he tell that to earlier on?
Don.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, Don the.
Yeah.
The squat guy. Yeah, and the dog's name is King, and he kills the King. You know, it had a little bit of a meaning to it. I don't think it was just Melville's an ass for killing a dog. It was kind of a, you know, kind of a subtle, maybe not so subtle, but it was kind of a clue to what's going to happen with the King, the supermarket King.
Isn't it kind of funny, though, that people were so upset over that?
Yeah.
It's almost like more upset over that than over the other killings.
Right.
Because I kind of noticed that, too. Then in the next scene, we see Molly driving into Bemidji and listening to a Bomunk insurance commercial on the radio. And that was the whole scene of that. We didn't really go anywhere else with that. And I kind of wondered,
yeah,
was it just showing her coming back or?
Yeah, and they say in the commercial, get there before it's too late, which is kind of interesting because essentially her showing up at the time she did saves Lester's life.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, you're right. Oh, yeah, that's good. Okay, so then we see Lester in the bathroom at work, and he's taking the Band-Aid off that gunshot wound he has in his hand, and that was pretty gross.
Yeah.
They did a pretty good job of that. What'd you think?
Yeah, the festering wound.
Yeah, and he, like, grabs it and squeezes this white-looking pus stuff out of it. And so the lady from the office, the office lady, comes, hollers through the door and tells him that someone's there. And he goes out, and it's Wrench and Numbers. What'd you think about that?
Yeah,
was kind of a weird scene.
Did she tell him that, or did she tell Lester, hey, I'm going to Arby's for lunch, do you want anything? And then he says no, and she leaves, and he kind of comes out.
Oh,
and
okay.
And he's surprised that they're there. He doesn't know that they're there.
Okay. I couldn't hear what she was saying, and I didn't have my closed caption on, so I couldn't see it. And so I thought she was just saying, hey, someone's here for you. I didn't realize.
No, that's why she was so nice. She's saying, hey, we're going to Arby's. Can I bring you back something?
Okay. Well, that makes more sense than when he was so surprised when he came out and they were there. But he had to have been scared because he had just seen them at Gina Hess's house.
Did he see them or did they see him?
Both.
Okay.
Both. He looked out the window and then he kind of hunkered down in the chair he was sitting in and kind of was looking like that. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was overwhelmed by Kate Walsh. I missed all that little part.
Okay.
So Molly shows up and kind of saves the day by interrupting probably the last moments of Lester's life if this would have continued on.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that they would have let that drop. I thought it was funny that it was Wrench that was talking to him with, like, sign language.
Yeah, and on the internet, you want to know what he said?
I'd love to know, yeah.
He, somebody on Reddit, let me see if I got it here, Handy Signs on Reddit has the translation from the American Sign Language, and this is how it goes. So Lester, haha, so what can I do for you fellas then? Because we're kind of busy right now. Which that was
nobody
funny.
In there.
Yeah, that was
rotten.
Funny. So the deaf guy, who is Mr. Wrench, taps Lester on the shoulder and says, "You are tiny and baby-like." And Lester says, "What is that?" And Mr. Wrench signs, "You're running a small business in a small town. You're nothing, worthless." And Lester again, Lord Lester says, he doesn't understand. He says, "Nope, sorry." And so Numbers, the other guy, the other criminal guy, says, "Sam Hess," and he verbally says it, the guy who can speak. Lester's really disturbed, and he says, "Are you guys family of his?" And Mr. Wrench signs, which was kind of hard to see what he signs, and this guy, Handy Signs on Reddit, actually says this, "I can't make out what he signs since I can only see the side of him. I'm unsure of what he is talking about at the beginning when I believe he refers to a lion killing and then a king killing of some sorts. Lion is killed or is killing is what the guy signs. And then the people under the king are killed or is killing." And then he signs, "You're a joke. You're like a tiny little bug I wish I could squish." And then that's the end of the signing in that scene.
What do they think Lester, are they thinking, do you think that Lester was having an affair with Gina and so he killed Sam?
Or had Sam killed, or somehow he's connected to Sam being killed.
But I would think they would put it together that somebody from the insurance company is going to visit Sam's widow.
Yeah, but she's dancing around him and, like, lap dancing him. And
well, that's true. That's true. But do they not know her? I guess they don't. They don't know anything about her.
No, even if you did, I mean, if you saw that, you'd think they're having some sort of a romance or some sort of a sexual fling or something.
I guess that's a good point. Yeah. But I thought, well,
Molly comes in, and as they're leaving, she's like, oh, who are those guys? And he's like, I don't know, but they're going on vacation in Mexico, which is the second mention there of Mexico, because the girl with the spiders mentioned Mexico. That was that was something that I took note of. But Lester sniffs a sail out with Molly. That was funny too. Like, oh, I might have business here.
Oh, I know. But he covers for these guys when she comes in.
Yeah.
And I thought that was kind of interesting that Lester, because we're talking about Lester here, would instinctually do that.
Well, he's trying to keep as low of a profile as possible. And if he says, these guys are threatening me, officer, please help me.
Yeah, but those guys were fixing to dunk him in a early grave water hole.
Lester's he's not a long-term planner. You know, he's kind of a stay low, stay quiet, hope things will turn out eventually okay. You know, he's just trying to stay low. He's trying to stay under the radar of everybody.
Yeah, yeah. It was just, I really wasn't expecting him to cover for, maybe not notify Molly of what was going on, but he really covered for him, and I thought it just kind of threw me.
He covered for himself, not for them so much.
Well, he did, right. Well, but he had reason to be at Gina Hess's house. He had a reason to be there, and then these guys were kind of harassing him over it. But I guess because of his guilt and because of the situation he knows, then he feels like it's just better not to get the police involved in it in any way.
Yeah, of course. So Molly very cleverly lets him see Melville's picture.
Sorry. Hang on 1 second.
King is back. That was pretty funny. Right now, Michelle is taking out her curved knife and taking care of that dog. But at least we'll be able to keep podcasting.
Are you there?
Yep.
Sorry. No idea. Butterfly or something.
I'll leave that in. I'll leave that in
no,
the podcast.
Do not leave that in.
You probably didn't hear my comments.
I didn't. What'd you say? You'll I had to take the headphones off.
You can hear them on the playback.
No, do not leave that in.
So Molly's really smart. She lets Melville's picture spill out of the folder, and that's how she gets Lester's reaction to it.
Yeah, she did that definitely on purpose. That was her whole purpose of being there, and he reacted.
So Lester goes to Stavros's house,
right,
and sees his shrine, his religious shrine. More religion creeping into this one of Saint Lawrence, I guess, is the theme of the stained glass shrine. What'd you think of that?
I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure what to think about that. Stavros's explanation of what it was.
Yeah, he was a badass.
And I looked that up, and that's a true tale. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Like of St. Lawrence. Okay, I didn't know.
It's a religious. I guess it's as true as you can get. But it's kind of a religious story, right?
It's a religious story, but it's a story about a guy and what happened with him, and the tale about how he was killed was they had put him, from what I read, and it was, you know, but they'd put him on a, they kind of cooked him,
right?
And it was rumored that he did say that, you know, turn me over, I'm done, or something to that effect.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of...
So super spoilery and maybe nothing is the other part of this scene where the ice scraper picture is mounted on the wall. This also is all over Reddit, but did you connect the ice scraper with the ice scraper in the movie?
No, and I wasn't even sure what that was that he was looking at.
That's because you're in Tennessee. But yeah, it's a window ice scraper for scraping ice off your windshield. And that's how Steve Buscemi marked the buried money in the snow in Fargo the movie.
Right.
So the spoiler all over Reddit is that the king found that $1 million in, like, from the movie. And he memorialized it by putting the ice pick on the wall. And then that's the money, that's the that's the money that Don is blackmailing him for, that he doesn't even know why he's blackmailing him for. And I don't know. That's a theory on Reddit, but it's very interesting that that's what kind of happened, that maybe he found some money and that was marked by this ice scraper. And if it's got nothing, if that's not true at all, it's got nothing to do with this story. It's an incredible tribute back to the movie.
It really, really is. If it doesn't, if that's not true, then they should maybe hire the guys from Reddit to come in and give them the storyline.
Because why would a religious guy who has all these, you know, he's got the religious themed room, why would he have an ice scraper picture on the wall?
Yeah.
It's like they say on Reddit, it's like when you frame your first dollar bill of your business, you're like proud of, you know, you're earning money, or that's how you got started. That was the connection.
That's great. If that's not the story, that should be the story. That is great. Perfect.
So the other thing interesting is the real reason Stavros wants to hire Malvo is that he wants the dog killer caught. He's more worried about that than the blackmail and the, you know, the house invasion or and any of that. It's like the dog killer.
Well, I think that's what put him over the edge, but I think that was Malvo's intent anyway, as we see, is just to put Stavros over the edge. And that's where Stavros says that it couldn't have been his ex-wife. He realizes that at this point, because he says she wouldn't have done that to the dog.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting, too, because now he's kind of deducing that he's dealing with a bigger player than just his ex-wife. But his ex-wife, she didn't know, did she, about the ice scraper? Or if that's the story, she didn't know that, or does she?
Well, we don't know anything about the ice scraper.
Right, but she doesn't know. Does she know? Do we know if she knows where he got that money?
No, I don't think we know anything about the money. Don doesn't know about it, and he's blackmailing Stavros about it. I don't think we know anything about this mysterious money.
No, we don't know, but do you think his wife knows? Remember, she was talking to Malvo, and she says he didn't get it from his uncles, and she kind of insinuated that she knew where he got the money. I don't know. I just think it's important.
Yeah, that's a good point. She does laugh at it, like, oh, family, huh? That's the farthest thing from the truth.
Right. She talks about the uncles, one's in jail or whatever, one died when he was 10 or whatever. I don't know. I just kind of wonder who does know the real story, because that may be how we find out.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. That's a good point. Maybe she does know.
Okay, so then we go to Gus and Greta, and they're sitting at his desk, and he's going through the mug shots, and he's tired. You can tell he's like went through and went through and went through. He's making no progress, and this is where he admits to Greta that he made a mistake and that he's going to have to call the jurisdiction and tell them what he did, because he let the suspect get away, and Greta is the one that suggests that they do it in person.
Yeah.
And then we go to Molly, who goes into the chief's office, Bill's office.
Well, another interesting scene in the scene of Gus and Greta is between them in the background in the police department, there's a guy like giving a statement of some sort or sitting there. He's like a dead ringer for Jesus. If you ever go back and watch it, he's got like the long hair, the brown hair, the mustache, beard. He's thin, and his face looks like every portrayal you've ever seen of Jesus.
And I didn't notice
he's
that.
He's right between Gus and Greta in the background.
I'll anyway. Have to look for that when I watch again. I didn't notice that at all.
Okay, so anyway.
Okay. So Molly's in Bill's office, and she's showing him the photo of Malvo pulling the guy out, because she's actually gotten the photo from the accounting firm. The
videotape?
Yeah, the video.
Surveillance video.
Surveillance video. Thank you. She's gotten this. I couldn't remember that word to save my life. She's gotten the surveillance video photo of Malvo, and she's showing it to Bill. And then she tells him what she did with Lester, how she went into the office, and she goes, because I do need insurance, and kind of, you know, tries to soften it with that, and Bill's not having it.
Yeah.
He's mad at her. He tells her he's mad at her. He turns his back, literally, on her in the scene.
Right.
Why do you think he's so married to this position that he has?
He's just a power hungry public worker, you know, that's got, it's kind of the treadmill has moved him up a notch and he's just like going to let it go on. He's not a shaker and mover. He's just kind of a placeholder.
Yeah.
I think Bill and Molly's, their communication where he just kind of turns his back on her, like I'm done talking, and he pouts and that's the end of the conversation, stands in direct contrast to the next scene where Molly and Gus talk.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it shows the difference in someone being willing to admit an error or something that they feel like they should have done differently or seen differently.
It's a confession. It's essentially a confession. Like, this guy's pouring out his soul in very, very difficult terms to, you know, he's admitting he was afraid. He's admitting he didn't do his job. He's admitting that he might have been part of something that led to somebody else getting hurt. And he's communicating. He's struggling to communicate with Molly, where this guy, Bill, just turns his back and drinks his coffee like, this is over. I'm done talking to you. And he's not even man enough to say, Molly, this is over. Don't talk to me about this anymore and get back to work. He just pouts and turns away.
Yeah, he definitely acts very juvenile about it, whereas Gus just kind of lays it on the line and bears a soul and opens up to Molly.
Yeah.
And Molly, I think at first she was a little embarrassed for him, maybe, and the way he acted. I love this character's looks on her faces and stuff. I love that because you can just read everything she's feeling, or I feel like I can anyway. And she kind of has this look on her face like she is embarrassed for him that he's telling her this and he didn't do a good police work, which she values so much. And then Greta walks in.
Yep.
And they have that conversation about that Greta hasn't had her mother for 10 years. We find out Greta's supposed to be 12 in this scene. And so Molly completely realizes that they're alone and that's all Greta has.
Well, also, Molly completely realizes, we see how Molly is so hypersensitively tuned into what's going on, that she's a great investigator. Because at first she's confused. Like, she's like confused why Gus let the guy go. And then when Greta comes in, she understands instantly without even, you know, just she sees his daughter and she gets it. You know, she intuits it.
Yeah. Yeah. She definitely deduces that that's all he's got. Or that's all Greta has is her dad. And that was powerful to me. I really liked the way they did that. I like that scene coming together like that. And I like how Gus kind of admitted it. And I really liked how Molly accepted that and didn't make him feel bad. We see so much like Pearl with Lester. Can you imagine having been Pearl with Lester in that scene?
Yeah, well, there seems to be a burgeoning romance even potentially between Gus and Molly.
Oh, we hope. Don't we hope?
We?
Yeah, you and I and everybody else in the world.
I don't know.
I think we want them to. You don't?
I don't care either way, really, but I think it's interesting that they put that into play.
Oh, I definitely want to see it happen because she's such a good person. We like her, and he's such a good person, and Greta's such a good kid. I don't know.
So they go to have burgers at Molly's dad's diner. Did you notice this? That Greta's shirt is exactly the same as the tablecloth.
No, I didn't.
Exactly the same colors, the same pattern of black and white and gray checks, and the same size. It's like the tablecloth was cut into a shirt, and Greta's wearing it.
That's funny.
You got to watch that part again. I will. It's funny. Just more quirk, though. I don't know if it has any meaning. It's just quirky.
Yeah, I didn't notice it at all. This is where Molly brings up the spider story, and she tells them about the spider story, and says she wouldn't want to live in a world where stuff like that can happen. And I think she's talking about more than the spiders. I think she's kind of maybe seeing what her dad was telling her about the evilness. I could be reading too much into that, but I thought that was a pretty deep thing she said. I don't think she was just talking about the spiders. I mean, she's seen worse things than spiders even if they are coming out of a wound in somebody's neck. But well, she wouldn't want to live in a world.
This whole show is fraught with symbolism, so it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah. Okay, then we see Lester walking downstairs in his brother Chaz's home into his gun shrine, and he picks up a taser and he pockets it.
Yeah.
And Chaz turns around, and Lester asks him which gun makes the biggest hole. And then we see Lester and Chaz, and they're out shoot. Well, Lester shooting this automatic huge weapon from his waist, and Chaz in the background throwing his arms around and kind of cheering him on.
And Lester's got his eyes closed when he's shooting it too.
But Lester looked different.
Yeah, you think he's transforming into some sort of a murderer, like a real badass?
I think he's Breaking Bad.
Yeah, maybe.
I think he is, because he was a different guy. So then we go into, it's Malvo's voice, and he's reading the story of Moses.
Is that Malvo's voice?
Isn't it?
I don't know. I didn't catch that, if it is.
That's what I wrote down. So, I mean, I must have not even thought about it and just, you know, just knew. I could be wrong, but I believe it's Malvo. No, it's Malvo's voice. I'm pretty sure. And he was reading the story of Moses. It flashes to Wrench and Numbers are sitting in an ice fishing cabin. But then it flashes to Stavros, and he's taking more Adderall, and he's doing things like looking in a mirror at his tongue and weird stuff. I mean, you can tell that the medication's affecting him. And then he gets in the shower.
Yep.
And the shower turns to blood. And you hear Stavros screams as Malvo walks out to the trunk of his car, and you see the empty containers of pig's blood that he's covering up with a tarp. The water turning to blood is the first of the 10 plagues of Exodus, right?
Yeah, so that's kind of the end cap of this religiosity or religion theory theme of this show. So that the whoever was saying it was, whether it was Malvo or somebody else, but the 10 plagues is, you know, that biblical book of Exodus was what was being recited, I guess, while they show the blood.
And then we fade to black for the first time in place of fading to white. I don't know if that has any significance or not, but.
Yeah, I don't know. It kind of was different, huh?
I thought it was.
Did you did you try to unravel the Muddy Road name game? The Muddy Road is the name of the episode.
I did, and I found the same parable you were talking about. Well, it's about these two monks, Tanzin and Akito. They're traveling together down a muddy road, and a heavy rain was evidently still falling. And they come around a bend, and they meet this girl, and she's in this long kimono and a sash and stuff, and so she can't cross the road because it's muddy. And Tanzin lifts her and carries her across the mud. Akito just is unhappy with him doing that, and finally he can't restrain himself any longer, and he says, "We monks don't go near females, especially not young and lovely ones. It's dangerous. Why did you do that?" And Tanzin said, "I left the girl there. Are you still carrying her?"
Yeah.
Yeah.
So okay, go ahead.
Who do you think they're specifically talking about in this? Because, or anybody, because I can relate it to many of the characters at this point.
Well, I don't know if I related it to character matching character so much as I did that what the parable's message is, and that you should see a situation for the way it really is instead of the way that your religious or personal views twist it for you and obligate you to see it a certain way. The wise monk is just saying, "I just helped a girl cross the road, and that was it. It was over." And the unwise or unlearned one said, "Why are you attracted to this woman enough to carry her across the road?" And he kind of read meaning into it. So that's what I was trying to connect to the show. Like, how does this relate to the show? One way that I saw was like Numbers and Wrench see Lester with Gina, and they mistakenly assume that they're hooked up.
That's interesting. I didn't think of that. I was thinking more along the lines of Tanzin does what he needs to do and doesn't carry it with them after that. Ikido continues to carry. I think it kind of went back to what you said earlier about our sins and how we see it in other people. Like maybe Ikido was the one attracted to the girl. So that was the negativity that he saw in Tanzan doing what he did, even though Tanzan was just doing something innocent.
Yeah, he was being generous. The unwise monk read too much into it and carried that with him. Like, you had more connection to this female, which we should not have as monks, than you should have. And the wise monk just reminded him, all I did was help somebody. I didn't do it for any ulterior motive, like I want to stay right. connected to this attractive female.
Right.
So I think that was the message.
What was interesting, I had never heard of the Muddy Road parable before, and I love that we pick this kind of stuff out of, well, not we, but that they put this kind of stuff in these episodes, because I feel like it's great psychology for everybody learning as they want.
So what else in the show, can you remember? Anything that connects to like somebody misinterpreting something and taking it with them and being wrong? Like what about all the slanted interpretations by Phil's coworkers, that St. Paul guy, about why an evil person might come after him? He was a gambler, he was a child molester, or whatever. That was kind of a muddy road.
Yeah.
Some of them have to be wrong, right? It's probably one of those things, but not all of them.
Yeah, maybe, or maybe it had nothing to do with any of that. I mean, you would assume gambling maybe over, I don't know though, but yeah, and kind of misplacing the significance or blame.
Yeah, and Don Chump, the blackmailer, he's doing something without knowing why. That's muddy, that's unclear.
Yeah, I think everything maybe in his life's a little unclear. I don't know that he had a good... I don't see how he thought he could get away with that.
I don't think he thought it out very far through.
I don't think so either, no.
So yeah, that's it for episode 3. So episode 4 is next week. It's Eating the Blame.
Yeah, it looks like Lester's going to get himself into a little bit of a pinch next time. Did you see the... upcoming episode at
yeah,
the end.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, he gets his own trunk ride, it looks like.
Yeah. they got something with trunks in this, so.
All right, well, that's about all I got, unless you have anything else.
That's all I got. Looking forward to next week, though.
All right, well, I'll talk to you then.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Fargo TV is part of the West Coast Project website. You can connect with all of our podcasts at westcoastproject.com or leave a comment on Facebook/FargoTV. Thanks for listening.